So I just wanted to make sure that everybody here knows that you're not going to hear anything about Talbot in this lecture, right? I hope this is clear. And Miriam and I have been going back and forth on emails, and I wanted to make sure that she knows that I don't intend to say anything about Talbot. In fact, I'm going to concentrate on contemporary, place of photography in contemporary science, in hopes of resonance with what we develop in the next few days, which I'm very much looking forward to hearing. So briefly, this is what I have in mind. First of all, a little bit from the perspective of the social sciences and the humanities on what I would think of as the ruined relation between photography and truth, as a kind of a preface and hopefully also in line with interdisciplinary inquiries that we'll be doing in the next few days. The main part of this lecture is about photography outside of art in contemporary science, and I put together a list of 9 functions of photography in contemporary science, which I'll telegraph on the next screen. And then I have some brief conclusions about the families of photographic practices that that now obtain in science. So just to telegraph the 9 parts, major parts of this talk, photography as archive would be probably the one that the function of photography that most people would think of in relation to science. To that, I want to add a few others. Photography that's utilitarian but discarded, in other words, made by scientists and then thrown away. Photography that requires a connoisseur's attention, by which I mean photography that can't be read for quantitative information but needs to be appreciated in science. That's unusual. Photography entailing non-photographic imaging, photography that needs to be supplemented by something non-photographic. Photography that's perpetually inadequate to its subject but is nevertheless practiced widely in some sciences. Multidimensional photography and computational photography. These are practices where the image that you see is actually a small cross-section of a larger field of data. The end of the instant, which of course begins with Fox Talbot, I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot about that in the next few days, and the instant is ending even more definitively, I'd say, these days. The end of point of view, that is photographs that are not made from any single point of view, which I'll explain when I get to it. And then non-spatial photography, photographs that appear to represent space but actually don't. And the background screen here I will also explain when I get to it. So I have 2 items on my agenda, things I'd like to develop as I go along through this. First is this, that photography has conventionally been seen as a source of evidence for science, and I'm thinking of René Dastin and Peter Galison in the book on objectivity. In contemporary science, though, there are a number of senses in which photography is not archival or evidential, and I'm going to name a few of those as I go along. Second, writing on photography tends to emphasize the supposedly enormous paradigm shift, as people in the arts love to say, between analog and digital photography, and I feel that the way that that's sustained is by not looking carefully at photographic practices, and that the closer you look at photographic practices, the less that really is helpful. So the 9 are meant to be instances of that. So first of all, a kind of extended prelude having to do with art and social sciences and humanities, and I especially want to concentrate on documentary photography. I've been giving a number of lectures in the last couple of years on documentary photography, looking at documentary photography projects. This particular one is an image that's collected by Sigrid Lien, who works in Bergen. And so some of the images I show in background, by the way, in this talk are meant to be more or less attempts to avoid the gray screen that's so ubiquitous in PowerPoint, so I won't be talking about them in detail. But about documentary photography, it would seem to be that part of the social sciences and humanities to do with photography that would have most to say to science, because in documentary photography, evidence remains one of the principal functions of photography. Nominally, documentary would indicate an intention to use photographs to produce knowledge of facts or evidence. That is what used to be called positive facts, in emulation often of written documents. The problem is that, as a number of people have been pointing out since the 70s, documentary photographs or projects are also bound to ideologies, and there I think of the photography critic and historian Abigail Solomon Godot. And also, documentary projects have been used intentionally to critique capitalism, as in Alan Sekula and others. A couple blurred photographs here. These are for Miriam. Where's Miriam? There she is. Because I know you were originally planning on having Sugimoto here, so I thought you'd like a couple blurred photographs. These are done by students of a guy named Michael Renner, who teaches in the Hochschule in Basel, and these are documentary projects that his students have done. And this one in particular, the student decided that the only way to truly document their own institution was using blurred photography. So documentary photography has also been questioned as a class-based veridical tool, that I'm thinking of sociologists like Pierre Bourdieu, and also as an epistemologically dubious enterprise, thinking of Martha Rossley there, and one more set of these blurred photographs, which are also, by the way, in emulation of something very popular on Flickr now, and that is fake tilt and shift photography. If you haven't seen this, it's definitely worth going on Flickr and looking. Fake tilt and shift photography is when you take an ordinary photograph and put it in Photoshop and make it look like a view camera photograph that has shallow focus, thereby turning all enormous landscapes, I mean life-size landscapes, into what look like model train sets. Instant nostalgia. So then the question with documentary photography is, in light of these kind of critiques, what kind of functions can it still have? And I have some texts from Mikhail Renner in order to give a little opening into this topic. He points out this etymology of documentary in which docere, meaning to teach, instruct, inform, show, or describe, has within it a double meaning. And he says it would be important to take teaching and showing seriously as different. And he is a bit of a quotation from the essay in which he claims that the consequence of that would be that a photograph can only work as a document if it has a number of other photographs with it in a larger cultural context. It's an interesting claim, but it may also be that it defers the moment in which you ask of a photograph, can it be evidence? So I would rather make a slightly different separation, maybe in by way of emulating Wittgenstein, between telling and showing. So in that case, the fundamental issue, I think, is easier to see, and that is whether or not photographs can embody and express knowledge. And this then becomes a general question which can be asked about images. The other reason why I'm here, I mean, in England at the moment, is that the Tate is having a conference in, I think, 2 or 3 weeks on interpretation and theory. Several people, including me, are going to be exploring that theme, that wider theme. So a couple of examples. This is one of the screens from Abi Warburg's Mnemosyny project, which has been reconstructed several times. And there's a genealogy of this project, beginning with the original, going through Martin Warnke's build index that I'll show on the next screen, and culminating most recently with Marianne Mueller's political iconographic archive of vision that she's been working on at the Jacobs University outside Bremen. So I'm not going to introduce Warburg's project here, but just to say that its afterlife is, to put it mildly, strange. This is a bit of Martin Warnke's build index for political iconography, which was done with 300,000 postcards, so outdoing Warburg at his own project, and also making an enormous archive, supposedly, ultimately, or ideally, of all of the visual as seen through photography. And this is part of the one-page version of Marianne Mueller's current project, Archive of Vision, in which she has, it's a sort of a color laminated plastic card that she uses to introduce her project. And this is an example of the kind of thing that she has. At the moment, she has only 2,500 fully annotated images, but she's hoping for much more. And they go by categories that she's invented partly from Warnke and then ultimately from Warburg. There she is. And one of her colleagues, Peter Ludus, whose name's at the bottom there, has taken this, I suppose, the next step, and that is he's relinquished, actually, the responsibility of a human observer to look at photographs. He's gotten some people from computer sciences to do automatic scanning of news broadcasts across European sources in order to see the percentage of time on each newscast that's spent on, say, the news anchor's face or the general scene or the detailed scene and so on. There's a kind of an endlessness about that particular archive. I'm not drawing a conclusion here, except to say that if the literal sense of the documentary project has now had to more or less escape into these kinds of hypertrophied classificatory projects. In terms of the philosophy of the documentary, I think one of the most interesting examples is Trevor Paglen. He's an artist who locates and photographs things that we're not meant to know about. This is one of his books. Some of them have been very popular. They sell a lot of copies, as you can imagine, with titles like that. This is one of his images, which is of a military satellite streaking by. These are satellites which supposedly whose location is supposedly unknown, but of course it's easy to find the location, so he does these photographs of them. That's another one. And he also creeps up as closely as he can to classified military installations in the States and takes photographs of sinister office workers. One of his principal points of reference is a fellow named John Pike, and I'll show you two screens of John Pike's work before I show you Trevor Paglen's conclusion about them. This is John Pike's Public Eye project, which, as far as I can see, stopped in 2006. What he was doing was he was getting private subscriptions to hire commercial satellites to fly over parts of the world that had politically sensitive things to look at, and then compare satellite images that existed previously with the ones that he had commissioned. Actually, on this screen, for some reason, I have two older ones, but this is what his website looks like. He does things like the nuclear reactor in North Korea and uranium enrichment in Hyderabad, and especially interesting for him is the Dimona nuclear facility in Israel. And in that case, by the way, this is a topic that's just waiting for some graduate student to write a dissertation on, because the United States has a law that the satellite photographs of Israel have to be blurred to a 2-meter resolution. So even though he commissioned a satellite to go to photograph Dimona, he had to blur the images before he put them on his website. So with all of this then in hand, he then asks experts to try to interpret the scenes in the name of increasing public knowledge and power over the military-industrial complex's version of itself. So here's Trevor Paglen on John Pike's work. He says, and this will be the only screen that I read in this lecture, but it's worth reading. I ultimately like the project, not because I think they're particularly revelatory or evidentiary, but because they help to create a visual vocabulary with which to think about politics and space. Photo interpretation is one of those murky arts, as we've seen most strikingly with the infamous Colin Powell UN presentation, but having those images somehow helps to put the things they purportedly depict into our cultural political consciousness. In my own work, I'm wholly unconcerned with any evidentiary role of the images. They really are meant to be art images. A successful image for me in my own work is one that makes a statement and simultaneously undermines any possibility of a traditional truth claim based on that image. It's a sense of seeing, not seeing, that I'm trying to capture. There's also a performative gesture I'm interested in. What are the politics of photographing some of these things, even though photographs themselves don't show anything? This is a really, really eloquent statement of a very under-theorized part of contemporary photography, and for that matter, art theory, that is the realm between showing and telling. Showing and saying, if you want to put it that way. I consider that this is something that's awaiting a better articulation by the next generation of art theorists, because the showing-saying dichotomy has been widely written about, but the space that a lot of artists, especially politically committed people like Trevor are interested in, is pretty trackless, and you get to use words like performative especially because you know you're not going to be asked to define them. Okay, on to the main part of this talk, 9 functions of photography in contemporary science. More or less random, except the first one on the archive, and I just want to introduce this with a few screens. This material I'm going to show you comes mostly out of an exhibition that I did when I was working in Cork in 2005. We had 30 different departments in the university in the exhibition. I had written a letter, an email, to all the faculty saying, do you use images in your work? Would you like to be in this exhibition? I got about 60 responses from about 60 different departments and chose 30 of them. Every person who was in it got about 1,000 words of wall text, and they were told that they should not popularize. I had to work with some of them in order to make their text legible at all. But the idea was to let them speak in their own words about their production and consumption of images. And they had one big picture, because this was the university art gallery, and the curator told me that that even though this wasn't in our exhibition, we had to behave as if it was. So we had to have one really large, attractive image to get people to go and look. But it was basically a text-driven exhibition. They were meant to be able to talk about their work in their own terms. So this was a pretty good cross-section of image production across the university. Pretty fair, I think. We had 3 that were nominally art, 1 from an art historian. The rest were in all of these other fields. And I'll show you two of these just to give you a sense of that in a second. Three books resulted from this. One is the book Visual Practices Across the University. And the closest to this that I'm aware is a book by Andreas Bayer, teaches in Basel, called Bild und Erkenntnis. Both of these are available on Amazon Deutschland. Also, we did an exhibition which became a book called Visual Literacy. The publisher, the North American publisher, this is Routledge, New York, told me that no one reads science in relation to images, so they had I had to go elsewhere for the science stuff. So we split it, and the science stuff went into that book that I'm listing first. And then they told me that no one wants to read an edited volume in which the contributors are not known to anyone. So they took the famous people and put them in this one that I'm showing under number two, leaving this one, which I think is equally interesting, to be published elsewhere by Intellect Books, book on visual cultures. There's a nice, there are a lot of interesting moral to be drawn there about international publishing, which we can get into afterwards, and plenty of stories to tell about that. So just two screens to show you the kind of thing that's in the book. This is a typical contribution, the beginning of their text, and a typical image, which I'll show you again in another context. And then just to show you, this really was wide-ranging. We had a dentist from the Department of Restorative Dentistry in the University Hospital who really wanted to let everyone know how difficult it is to choose the colors of porcelain teeth. So he put this display up. And this came along with a mirror, which was lit by a color-corrected light, so that people who read the thousand-odd words of wall text could then classify their own teeth and go to their dentist and say, I want a tooth G4, or something like that. I don't know if anyone ever did. We actually found out from this a fair amount of interesting color theory. Those middle three groups are actually color wheels, even though the hue of teeth is never intense. It doesn't have much chroma. Chroma is low. Nevertheless, you can not only have white teeth, yellow teeth, and brown teeth, you can have red teeth and green teeth and blue teeth. The colors are so subtle that the dentists who use these are admonished not to compare their tray to the patient's mouth more than 5 seconds at a time, because their eyes will acclimate too much and they won't be able to see these very subtle colors. So I was also hoping that in the exhibition this would be a rejoinder to local artists in Cork, who, of course, always are perpetually saying that they know colors better than anyone else. Okay, so the first of the nine, Photography is Archive. This is the only one which I really have in any sort of order, just because this is the function which is most often associated with photography and science. From the exhibition, this is two pictures of 3D laser-scanned inscribed stones, Irish stones that are still often outside, unprotected from acid rain, and whose inscriptions are rapidly disappearing. This is actually quite a depressing subject because there are photographs from the early 20th century of these same stones which show they're completely legible. They had remained legible for centuries, and in the course of the last century, they've almost completely disappeared in some cases. So the 3D laser scanning produces an archive in a traditional sense of archive. And here I'm meaning that in this way, that these images are preserved and used repeatedly. In other words, they're a resource, and they're a source of quantifiable information. Of course, in science, the information from an image in an image is meant to be quantifiable in most instances. So these would conform to that sense of archival use. But this is all I have to say under this first heading, because we found in this exhibition that this kind of use is not common in the sciences. Many other kinds senses of photography are. So my second topic, photography that's utilitarian but is then discarded. So this is a bit of a film given to us by a person in the zoology department who was studying the flight of birds. And this is before he got his high-tech camera and cage to contain the birds. So every time he did this, he had to go and catch the bird in his lab. I particularly love this sequence that's coming up because this is where I learned that when a bird, or at least this kind of bird, flies, its wings touch at the tips at the top of the cycle, which I hadn't known before. So anyway, this is the bird going free in his lab. So he wanted to show us this and other photographs that he had taken. His special study was something whose technical term I forget, but something, it's called something like the surface effect, where ducks and other birds can go just a foot over the water because the air is compressed between their wings and the water. So the next thing that he did was put these films into a computer program and measure the outline of the wings. At this point, and from this point forward, his photographs were no longer of any use to him. Once they'd be measured, they were discarded. This was the first instance that we discovered of something that I think runs against the grain in the humanities and arts, where we imagine photographs to be in and of themselves things that you keep and go back to study, but actually have a number of examples like this. I think in this lecture I'm only going to show one more. And then after he had done the outline tracing in the computer and discarded the photographs and the films, he would then measure them. So actually there's a step beyond this in which that outline is reduced to numbers, and the numbers are the science. So something for people who are interested in photography or imaging in general and the sciences to get used to if they come out of the humanities, social sciences and arts, is the unfortunate fact, I suppose you could say, that images are often discarded. Actually, I ran across this first when I was a couple of years ago looking into history of 20th century physics, and I was looking for photographic plates that were used to track cosmic rays, and the plates were sent up in balloons. And I wrote to a number of people. Peter Galison was one of them, and Hans Bethe and a number of others. So I'm fairly convinced now when I say that none of these exist. Because they were taken down, taken apart, they were glass slides with emulsion in between, measured and discarded. Here's another example, second on this subject. So a person in the Department of Food Science, named something similar to that, sent me this and said, here's your picture for your exhibition. I think it's beautiful, so you'll like it. And I had to write back, as I did to several people, and say, this is not really a science is secretly beautiful exhibition. I'm really not interested in the beauty of your image. I just really like to know what it is and how you use it. And he said, okay, it's an electrophoresis gel, and I study cheddar cheese. And he sent me a couple of pictures of his lab assistants with the gel plates. So you can see there, between the two white plastic, in the white plastic frame, is the electrophoresis gel. And at the top of it are put little dots of cheddar cheese, and then it's put into an electric current, and the electric current carries the material partway down depending on the charge of the molecules. And then if it's dyed blue, it results in this kind of a picture. I said, okay, so this is something, you know, legitimate that you're using for purposes other than beauty. Can you give me a published paper that has this in? And he said, well, not exactly, but I can show you this. Which tells you, which labels what they call the tracks. So what you have here on the left is the casein, which is the protein that ultimately causes produces flavor in cheddar cheese. On the left, the fresh one, and then the next lanes over, the six lanes in the rest of this, are aged cheddar cheese, and you can see how the casein proteins break down, the alpha and beta chains break down into smaller units, causing the flavors that he was studying. But he said, but this is not a published piece. This is just something that I use for my students to explain to them what's going on. And I said, well, what is it? What is published? And he said, well, sometimes we publish these. And he gave me this. So these are the individual lanes on their sides scanned, and the densities of the individual tracks are determined. And then the original electrophoresis gel, the photograph of it, are both thrown away. In addition, it turns out that you don't even need to dye it blue in order for the scanner to see it. You can see they're gray here. It doesn't matter if it's blue because the scanner can see the faint gray traces of the actual cheese. They don't need to have it beautiful blue like this. So I said, okay, fine. What in the world is this image you just sent me? And he said, well, that we just do for people like you. and also when we're going to be on the cover of Nature or Science and one of these other, then we need a beautiful picture. And there are people in several universities, I'm sure that Cambridge have one, who specialize in helping the scientists to re-photograph their material when they're about to be on the cover of some publication. The best known of these is Felice Frankel, who works in the Edgerton, that's as in Doc Edgerton, imaging lab at MIT. And she has a background as a landscape photographer and helps the scientists make pretty pictures for publicity purposes. So I would say here, photography is not functioning as an archive. But differently this time, not functioning differently than it was not functioning before, because in this case, the images are not preserved or reused, and they're also not immediately, in this sense anyway, the source of quantitative information. Third topic then, photography that requires a connoisseur's attention. So I suppose this is a deliberate misuse of that word connoisseur, but I'll specify that. We had a display by someone named Nolan Parfrey. He's an expert on this particular kidney disease. He gave us an exhibition from which I'd say that most of us learned almost nothing. And the reason we learned so little from it is because in his field, in his specialty, it's necessary to read images in a non-quantitative fashion. As he says there at the beginning, diagnosis is not straightforward. He uses a number of different kinds of photographs. So, for example, a light microscope photograph, also a TEM, transmission electron microscope photograph that you see at the top there. And in each one of these cases, what he's looking for is qualitative differences, the density of a membrane, the thickness of a membrane, and they're all relative, not only to other samples, but also relative in between the different imaging technologies. So it takes literally a lifetime of experience in order to read these things. I forgot I didn't have another slide there. So this was an interesting moment, too, and it was only replicated in our exhibition in other people from medicine. And I'll come back to this at the end of the talk. I'm calling it a connoisseur's attention, for lack of a better word. Maybe we can think of a better one to describe it. But what I mean, of course, is that it can't be measured. There's nothing to measure. There's only experience to be had. I had a small insight into this myself when I was given a tutorial on how to read a chest x-ray by someone in another institution, an expert on pre-tubercular lesions. And I was in his office looking at x-rays under optimal viewing conditions on the light screen from like a foot and a half away. And he was saying to me, he would point at something and say to me, "You see that?" And to me, it looked like every other faintly gray splotch. And at one point, he said, "Did you know that women and men have differently shaped ends to their ribs? And this is one of the ways that you can sometimes tell the gender difference in an x-ray." Like, for example, he said, "This is obviously a woman." And he pointed to the end of one of the ribs on the chest x-ray and said, "See, that's rounded." And I couldn't see it. I was a foot and a half away from it. And I thought of myself as someone who was fairly good at looking at things, but I couldn't see anything. So that's another example along those same lines. That's why in the height of tuberculosis epidemic, that was why people like that were in such demand. Fourth theme, photography that requires non-photographic imaging support. And here one of our most interesting examples was a chapter, an exhibition on viruses. Where the person, he didn't mention this guy, Stephen Harrison, whose name's in the first line, but actually Stephen McGrath was, in a way, following this book called What Does a Virus Look Like? By Stephen Harrison, which is a wonderful little book. Both of them experts on imaging, making images of viruses. And so his first observation about his own field was that he needed a number of different imaging technologies, photography and others, which I'll show you. And that they couldn't be put together into a single image. There's an interesting theorist here, Bill Wimsatt, who works at University of Chicago. He's theorized this in terms of in the field of genetics more generally, but it fits this case of viruses. He calls this issue the thicket of illustration, and it apparently echoes something that people who work in genetics often say, and that is that they have to use different technologies because they're mutually incompatible, even though they're of the same subject. This is another thing which I think people in the arts and humanities might have a harder time adjusting to, because even though, of course, the sketches for a painting are different from the painting is the ultimate instantiation of those sketches, and they're meant to be compatible in a general sense, that one person made them and so on. But here, the assumption is you have to use as many technologies as you can because your subject is inherently incapable or resistant to being imaged adequately in any single technology. So I'll show you some of, I think it was about a dozen different imaging technologies. Some of them are photographic, some of them aren't. So the raw data from the genetics of the virus is that screen at the top, and the tiny, underneath the graph there, there's a row of tiny letters, which are the base pairs, the DNA base pairs, the initials of them, running along there. The next step, then, is to make a diagram like this, which tries to find individual genes and to coordinate them with the ways that they're expressed in the virus. You have electrophoresis gels like this one, and even though I'm not showing it, of course, you have lots of transmission electron micrographs of viruses as well. Then there are these kind of things, space-filling models, which are, in this case, modeling the whole head of one of the viruses. And then there's a lot of PowerPoint, in which each individual object in the PowerPoint file can be moved around and corresponds to one gene. So the second of the diagrams I showed is repeated in the schematic form at the top there and correlated with the different parts of the virus. The notion here, Wimsatt's notion, is that there is no ideal visualization of these objects because the visualizations compete against each other. Fifth theme, photography that is perpetually inadequate to its subject. And this is something which, of course, happens a lot in art. And if we had had Sugimoto here, we'd be talking a lot about that, this kind of issue. But in science, of course, you don't want your image to be perpetually inadequate. Sometimes you just have to put up with that. My examples here are images of individual gold atoms done by this man named Jan-Olof Bovin, whose name has fallen a little bit off the screen here. But he works in Lund. And for at least a decade, maybe two decades, he's been one of the premier researchers in this field. That's a crystal of gold atoms, single stills from movies that he makes. These are perpetually limited because of the uncertainty principle. They're never going to be more exact than they are right now. I show you the first couple of these small just to, as a reminder that these are very low resolution. There's only a few pixels to these. So in this one, a single gold atom is appearing and disappearing at the edge of a crystal. This one is a gold cluster, a microcrystal, which is changing its shape. When I first saw these, by the way, I was amazed. In my naivete, I thought of crystals as solid things that stayed put. But actually, they're always moving around when they can. In this one, a surface layer of gold atoms is moving back and forth across the left-hand side there. And it's also, of course, irresistible to impute intentionality to these gold atoms. They can't settle down. They're always moving back and forth. Here, a cluster of them appears near the surface of the crystal. And then I have a couple of two more examples of these, basically just because they're irresistible. In this one, two individual atoms are at first attracted to each other that you see at the top there, top stills, and I'll show you the video in a second. And then when they get too close, the repulsive forces overcome the attractive forces and they speed apart. But when they're apart, then the one follows, quote unquote, the other one, making a little kind of a dance. You'll see it at the top of the screen here. And the last one is just a lovely example of the cliche in the humanities taken from physics that observation destroys the object that's being destroyed, I mean, that's being looked at. So here's a cluster of gold atoms that diffuses over the course of this video loop because of the electrons that are bombarding it in order to make these images. So there is an entire field of inquiry about real-time motions of atoms, mostly in and around crystals and on surfaces, which will never be improved. It's always going to be at this level. If the positions are going to be known to this accuracy, then the details are always going to be known to this accuracy as well. Okay, multidimensional photography. So here's that image that I showed earlier. A multidimensional photography, generally speaking, is photography in which the image that you see is either comprised of stacks of images that are put together, which is now a common feature of digital cameras, or there's data which is not visualized in this particular image. It can be both of those things, which I think maybe should be treated distinctly, but at any rate, treating them together here. So the example from our exhibition was aerial photographs of Cork and also County Cork that were taken on several flybys using a camera that one person in civil engineering named Philip Dokane had procured somewhere. This camera was the duplicate of one that was then currently on Mars in one of the NASA missions. So he had a very high resolution set of photographs of the city and of the surrounding county. That's actually in the university. That's the student union with a student gathered in front of it on the right. But the camera that took this was multidimensional in the sense that it had 9 CCD lines feeding into it. 4 of them were monochromatic and 5 panchromatic, as you can see in that diagram. And so as the plane flew, it was taking actually 9 different stacks of information. And also, by the way, continuously, these were all being sewn together using GPS onto the national grid. So the national grid itself would form, say, a 10th layer. So the result of this was that it could be used for a lot of different purposes. And here, for example, this image is made into an altitude map. And one of the first uses of this was commissioned by the city, and it was to find out what would happen if the city flooded, because part of the city of Cork is actually below sea level. And it was just last year that actually Cork did flood for a different reason. They opened a levee thinking the levee was going to break, and it flooded the downtown. The people who commissioned this were surprised to find that if the ocean ever did find its way into the city, the first area to go underwater would be the police station. So multidimensional photography is also a part of a growing field called computational photography. If you look on Wikipedia for a definition of this, you get sent to a course that was taught, I think, in Berkeley or MIT in 2005, which is really the place where this term got started. But the Wikipedia entry, don't know who wrote it, of course, says that computational photography is an enhancement of digital photography, sort of taking it to the next step. But actually, the only useful definition of it is that it is photography, digital or analog, but of course almost always digital, in which you're adding computational methods, such as stacking, which I was just mentioning, 3D modeling, using several photographs to reconstruct a 3D environment, and also and especially HDR, which stands for high dynamic range. And those of you who are into photography or have the latest digital camera will know that HDR is a technology that's used originally developed to take pictures of things like sunsets, where you have a photographic subject that's very, very bright in one place and dark in another, something that photography's never been able to handle. And when HDR first came in, you would take a series of exposures and then you put them in a computer using special software, put them together. Now that's done automatically in the camera. So you just point your camera at the sunset, it rapidly takes a whole series of exposures and does this for you. And it's used on Flickr to produce the most appalling kitsch. Because if you do it right or wrong, if you tweak your parameters, you end up with these Technicolor sunsets. They're really horrifying looking images. But that's computational photography. And there's a relation between computational photography and the quote-unquote statistical or logic tradition that's studied by Peter Galison in the book on 20th century microphysics called Image and Logic. Because computational or multidimensional photography is photography in which what matters is an aggregate, some statistical aggregate, some combinatorial result of a number of different photographs. In terms of science, it often means that the image that you see is really only a fraction of the full image. And that is another concept which I think is pretty much unknown in the arts. If the closest analog, I would think, would be something like conceptual art, where the object you see, the document or something, is meant to stand for many other things. But in terms of traditional media, it would be odd to look at the thing, the Mona Lisa or whatever, and say, oh, well, yes, but of course there are so many dimensions that are visible dimensions but are withheld from me here. So it's an unusual way to think about images, but increasingly prevalent. Okay, the end of the instant. So I know we're going to be hearing about Talbot and the end of the instant in the next few days. I think you could even use this as a provisional definition of photography from the very beginning. It's about eroding the idea of the instant. But that erosion has accelerated, I would say, in recent years. And I'll show you a little table here and some examples. So if you're interested in an instant, which would only last, say, a millisecond, you can use an ordinary camera. Then you capture things on the level of a thousandth of a second. If you're interested in microseconds, a millionth of a second, you need something like Sam Edgerton's Rapitronic cameras, which I'll show you on the next screens after this table, which had the capacity to record just a few millionths of a second. Nanoseconds, a billionth of a second, can be captured by what are called gated still video cameras, which are image intensifiers coupled with CCDs. They've resolved so far down to 100 nanoseconds. And these things are used fairly prevalently in science labs. I saw one in a lab which studies how particles aggregate into pyramids when they fall down and how they move. Picosecond, I don't know if there's any technology that's especially for that range, but femtoseconds are resolved by smear or streak cameras, as they're called, which resolve down to 300 femtoseconds. And I might note on this table before I go on that the cameras in the lines 2, 3, and 5 were all developed by the U.S. military. And this one that I've just put on, this femtosecond street cameras, were developed relatively recently. And the purpose was to be able to see what happens to a particular kind of, I don't know what the proper word for it is, big bullet or something, that's shot from a special gun which pierces the armor of tanks used in Afghanistan and Iraq. And this particular bullet or projectile is designed to change shape as it goes through the air before it hits the tank, so as to produce this, get this capacity to go through the tank's armor. Attoseconds, I don't think have been yet resolved, something for scientists to work on. There is a source, but it fell off the screen there at the bottom. So I'll show you a couple of Edgerton's photographs, which were the first to enter that millionth of a second region. A couple years ago, I was involved in an exhibition of Edgerton's photographs, for which about 60 that had never been seen before were shown. And some of these are still classified as to date and place. The reason for the paranoia on the part of the Department of Energy is that originally the shape of the explosion in the first few millionths of a second could be used to determine the shape of the compression chambers that compress the uranium to produce a bomb. But this now declassified material also includes things that really should be revelations, like this one and a couple of others like it, which show that there were atomic tests done from balloons. And this is something that the U.S. military still denies. Most of the images look like this, and this is one of three or four that were in the public domain before this exhibition. This one was once reproduced in National Geographic with the credit Department of Energy, but when I contacted the Department of Energy, they said that they had never been contacted by the National Geographic and they didn't own any photographs. So what you're looking at here is some number of millionths of a second after the first explosion, which took place on the top of a tower. These are the compression the echoes of the shapes of the compression chamber as the shock, as the explosion goes outward. And these are that's ionized air that's working its way down the wires that are supporting the tower. So in another few millionths of a second, it looks like this. And these things down here are Joshua trees, which are a kind of cactus-like tree that is common in the desert in the Southwest in the States. They're about 10 feet high. So that explosion there is about 300 feet high. So these were some of the first images to be in that order of magnitude of resolving an instant. This is, of course, beyond phenomenology in the sense that in the phenomenology of the atomic explosion, you have essentially just three moments. One is the flash, then the ball of fire, which expanded up to the size of the sky, according to Oppenheimer and people who described it. It was very hard to photograph, obviously, and then the mushroom cloud. And these things come before the flash, so they're a fourth level. And then just a couple of examples of microsecond films. These are negatives showing bursts of light, which are plasma coming out of an accelerator. And what the experimenters were doing were watching the behavior of waves that were in the plasma and how you could modify the wave by putting in things like, in this case, a lithium pellet. And it's cut off at the bottom here, but those are the seconds and microseconds. Then the end of point of view, another thing which I don't think is reached the humanities and arts as such. So this is a video loop of a polymer film crystallizing. And the reason that this is an example of the end of point of view is that this is done with a scanning probe microscope, which works by taking a small metal needle and raster scanning a surface and looking and measuring electrical resistance. And so each individual frame of this film was never, quote unquote, seen from above the surface, but it was composed of a series of scans across the surface. And so all the family of microscopes that work in this way, none of them produce images, still or moving images, of course, which represent an object from a point of view. The slide I was using in the background screens that I've been using for the title screens is from one of these two films. It's done by somebody who is watching individual layers of atoms being deposited on some platinum group metal surface. So each one of these terraces is one atom thick. And apparently these films are very hard to, they're rare and hard to make because there's some skill involved in keeping the needle on the surface as the needle grows. But each individual frame of both of these films, even though it appears to be showing terraces from above, as you can see when it appears to zoom back, is actually not apart from the surface itself. So there is no point of view. And then the last topic, non-spatial photography. We had, for some reason, several different exhibitions or proposals to show images of the center of the galaxy, because over the years, the center of the galaxy has been the object of increasing attention as telescopes and technologies have improved. And this is an image of some of the clouds of gas around the galactic center, which is an astronomical image in the usual sense, that is to say, that this is, in terrestrial terms, left and right, in terrestrial terms, up and down, right ascension, declination, in this. So it's ordinary in that sense that it represents space. But most of the images of astronomical objects where movement is of interest are not that sort. And this is an exhibition proposal which we had to accept because it was proposed, quote-unquote, by the president of the university, Jerry Rickson. So we had to accept it. This is his early work as an astrophysicist before he went into administrative work from 1974 from National Geographic. So what you're looking at here is what appears to be a first-generation computer image of the center of the galaxy, but actually only the x-axis is spatial. So that you can read left and right. But when you read up and down, what you're actually reading is radial velocity. So that means that this point here, for example, this area here is clouds of gas that are to the right of the center of the galaxy and are going away from you very fast. And those on the upper left are to the left of the center and are coming toward you very fast. So images like this are made to look like pictures because the scientists find it easier when the thing they're dealing with looks like a picture. There was a lot of speculation about this at the time of the exhibition. I don't know if anyone has theorized this yet, but it seems to be widely held practice. So more recently, images again of the center of the galaxy, the exact same thing at a higher level of resolution, where you see the velocity scale on the left and its spatial scale on the right. Here's an even more complicated one, which to me passes the boundary of intuition. At least I can't picture this. It looks like a picture of the person here studying binary star systems. So it looks like a picture through a telescope, but actually it's a velocity-velocity graph. So this is velocity left and right, and this is velocity up and down. It's not different in terms of abstraction from an XY Cartesian graph, but it helps the scientists to see it as an image, as a picture. Whatever, the words are a little bit inadequate there. The same kind of thing happens in a less esoteric subject. There was a guy from speech therapy who wanted us to have an exhibition on the sound spectrograms. That's a bird song, but the ones that he gave us were people speaking different dialects. He was doing studies of regional dialects in Ireland. But this kind of thing is just more familiar to us because of maybe music notation. It is time this way and pitch this way, and resolution of pitch is color-coded. So there are actually three dimensions there, none of which are spatial, and yet it helps to see it spatially. Here's my most complicated example. This is a video that appeared on the internet maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago of Wolf-Rayet star, which is a kind of star that throws off ionized gas. It's spinning because it has an unseen companion. And this was a big quote-unquote hit on the internet among science buffs, I guess, because it's amazing to think that out there in space there's a pinwheel that's revolving. Actually, this image is made in a very counterintuitive way. It's actually made up of interference pictures. It's actually a calculation of interference between wavelengths brought in by three radio telescopes. So the first reason that animation is not what it appears to be is that it represents infrared wavelengths, which you wouldn't be able to see. Therefore, it's false colored. It also uses a thing called heterodyne detection, in which you're actually using the image. You're using radio waves carried in wires to make the image. And it's done with an interferometer array, that is three dishes in a field. Each one of those dishes sees only intensities. Any two of them interfere with each other, producing this pattern, and all three of them, by real scientific magic, as far as I'm concerned, make images which are then put together to make the video. this is the schematic of the arrangement. Here are the three dishes, which are in the field. And most amazingly, they need delay lines because this one is a little bit farther from the Wolf-Rayet star than this one is because it's on the other side of the field. So we need to delay the signal so that they're perfectly in sync. And then they're put into splitters, and they're correlated, and they're produced as single stills, which are then put together to form this. So the image is built out of what's not visible several times over, the wavelength, which is everyone's used to now because of Hubble, false color, and so on. Also because it's interferometry, not image-making. No single part of this is an image-making instrument. It uses heterodyne reduction to deal with the frequencies, and also it serves non-visible ends. Because, again, this was just the image that was made by the lab, you might say, for fun, because they knew they could do it, but it wasn't the science that they published. So, some conclusions about photography's families in two screens, and then a couple more screens of conclusions. In the background here, this is things that I was collecting a few years ago, definitions of seeing in different languages. So, I think it's possible to take these range of photographic practices and group them as you would group families. I'll do this on two screens. First of all, families of image construction. And the reason that I was interested in doing this is twofold. First of all, to try to make sense out of this material, to try to organize it, but also because there was some resistance there, that university, to the idea of studying the visual in this way, because it was said that image-making practices are more or less, practically speaking, infinite. So you couldn't actually construct an introductory university course to deal with the visual, which is something that a lot of people want to do, because, so it was said, these practices are not, they can't be counted, they can't be arranged, and therefore they can't be taught in any plausible way in a year. So we also had a kind of practical reason to want to try to group these things. So in terms of image construction, and then the next screen I'll show image interpretation. In terms of image construction, there are image manipulation programs. Photoshop's the one that people in the arts know, but NIH image is used by a large part of the English-speaking community of biologists. And if you look in magazines or journals like Cell, you'll recognize the color palettes that are in NIH image, which is a free software you can download. ImageJ and XBEM are also our commercial scientific image manipulation programs. Fourier transforms are a family of image construction, and which are, I think, the best litmus test of the difference between arts and sciences for those people in those inevitable conversations when I end up arguing with people saying, there's no real difference between the arts and sciences, you know, we're all friends and all the rest of that. This is a great litmus test for that in that kind of context, because a Fourier transform is in every scientific image manipulation software and no art and humanities image manipulation software. It's not in Photoshop, but it's in an NIH image. It's a way of taking an image with a click of a mouse and turning it into a graph of its own spatial frequencies, which can then be manipulated by erasing bits and so on to get rid of noise, basically, and then retransformed into the image in a cleaned-up version. It's controversial in science because if the scientists don't know the math behind the Fourier transforms, they're apt to change their images in ways that can't be changed back. So a physicist told me that that they don't often approve of the way that people in other fields use this technology, even though it's ubiquitous, because they end up ruining their own evidence. Digital video editing is a family of image construction, so that art students, like in the place where I teach, will often go from one technology to another learning digital video editing. Map making and surveying were also well represented in our exhibition. A person from the archaeology department, in addition to that civil engineering example that I showed. Optical microscopy is a family in that people who are trained in one of these optical microscopy technologies will often be able to pick up other ones. So this is more or less what I mean by saying they're like language families. They can be learned to a reasonable degree of proficiency in a reasonable amount of time. Electron microscopy also forms a family. Videos that I was showing that were done without point of view are part of maybe a dozen different electron microscope technologies which people can learn. Maybe there's a dozen others, but not an infinite number. If there's a preeminent language family, I would say that is not art, but scientific and technical image manipulation. And by preeminent, I just mean at a basic level that those technologies that produce the most literature. More words for seeing. So then image interpretation, I also think, can be grouped in families. Chest x-rays that I mentioned. Of course, mammograms are problematic for the exact same reason that tubercular diagnoses in x-rays were, and that is that it can take more than a lifetime of experience to reach a reasonably proficiency in that. Histological diagnoses, as in the kidney disease, I would think of all of these things as medical semiotics technologies, but you can't jump from one to the other. The person who knows one is not going to be any better at these others. History of art is not a science one, but I can't resist putting it in because, of course, we have our methodologies, we have our psychoanalysis and our structuralism and so on, so I don't mind making a little pocket travesty of my own field by including into that, because students who learn one then learn some of the others and become proficient at a professional level in the same way, in an analogous way. Cognitive psychology and neurobiology of vision account for most of the literature on vision. If you look in the WorldCat and the other major databases, you find that writing on vision, with keywords like visuality and vision and seeing, is in the humanities hugely outnumbered by writing on vision in cognitive psychology and neurobiology. I think there's a claim on the part of some people in the humanities that image interpretation is theorized in the humanities, so that even if we don't have all the technologies, at least we're the people who are trying to figure out what's going on. But I think if there is a preeminent language family, it's probably medical semiotics. There's probably more literature there theorizing how to interpret than there is in the humanities. And again, I'm only saying this in a kind of statistical way, not making it as a content-driven claim. Okay, so just two conclusions. First of all, day-to-day scientific practice, I think, suggests that the digital-analog divide is not as important as people think it is. These nine the examples that I showed, you know, could be multiplied, and so could the different families of image interpretation and construction. And almost none of them depend on the material being digital. A small percentage of them do, of course. But that's hardly ever the issue. The issue is more production and use, purpose, production, and use. And these things, a number of these technologies, go all the way back to the origins of photography, obviously. They're like the top branches of the family tree of photography, is the way that I would think of them. Not all of them have started just in the last few years. Even things like computational photography obviously haven't started in the last few years because of things like panoramas and dioramas and other transformations of 2D into 3D. That, by the way, the background picture here is a picture that I took of one of my colleagues using an ophthalmologist slit lamp microscope. If you ever have a chance during your next eye exam to switch places with an ophthalmologist, definitely do it, because it's absolutely amazing. It's more amazing than an IMAX film, because your angle of view is huge, your resolution is enormous, and the other person's eye looks like, well, I don't know, it's like you're in a cave surrounded by the person's eye. It's an amazing experience. So my last conclusion, both scientific practices and arts and humanities practices suggest, I think, that it's necessary to revisit the driving concepts now in the field of archive, evidence, and veracity to include at least maybe these three things. First of all, political, pedagogic, and rhetorical uses, which are, of course, also already the subject of history of photography. Also, habitual and residual uses of photography, where photography is no longer needed, but made by habit or by convention, which is quite common, I think, in contemporary sciences. And then also, as a last gesture in the direction of this bridge between the arts and the sciences, the under-theorized region between claims about showing and telling. And that's as far as I'd be willing to go toward conclusions. Thanks. That's it.